Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, doctors, investors, journalists, politicians, and this week, ethicists, I think I said that word right, ethicists, that are leading the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check delivers the equivalent of the NHS Health Check in just 8 minutes using your phone. It's now the number one diagnostic test on the high street, apart from COVID and pregnancy tests. You can get it in Well, Boots, Superdrug, Asda, on Amazon, or on PocDoc's website, which is pocdoc.co. If you have any more questions about that, you can DM me, find me on Instagram, I'm on @SteveRoost, or contact us through the website. And thanks, as always, to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also, I always say this, but thank you so much to UK Health Radio for the live platform. Thank you to everyone listening live. It's amazing to have you and to see the numbers growing. Thank you if you're listening on demand on any of the podcast channels, podcast platforms. We get downloads from people in over 50 countries each month now, which is mind-blowing. And obviously, if you're watching on YouTube, on our Health Tech Hour channel on YouTube, or on my Instagram, which is @SteveRoost. Hi, it's great to see you. I'm waving right now, which you can't see if you're listening, but if you're watching, then you can see that. Thank you very much for tuning in. We really appreciate all of the support. So we have been on a couple of weeks break now. The previous show that we did was with Valentina Milanova, who is the founder of Day Diagnostics. Day is a gynecological health business developing medical devices around reproductive health for women. And their first or most successful product is called the diagnostic tampon, which helps increase the speed and ease of diagnosis of cervical cancer. So it's a really amazing show. Valentina doesn't pull any punches when it comes to talking about the state of women's health, women's healthcare, funding for women's healthcare. So if that's your bag, check out the show that we did with Valentina Milanova. It got some serious, huge traction. And onto today's show, we are tackling one of the, I guess, buzzwords, if you like, or other people have referred to it as a big bet. I guess both of those things are probably quite sort of infantilizing, if I can say that out, the concept. But it's definitely an area which every single healthcare system in the world has highlighted as a huge area of human development. And with well, if you listen to the people who are behind it, basically limitless applications. But it doesn't come without risks. So I'm talking about the area of genomics. And if you've read the 10-year plan, the NHS 10-year plan, which I'm sure many of you probably haven't, but if you did, well done for getting through it. It's mentioned, I think, 160 times in there. And on today's show, we have Dr. Natalie Banner, who is the Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer at Genomics England. Now, Genomics England is a public sector organization that was set up specifically to make sure that the advances in genomic research and medicine were being done properly, ethically, but also supporting UK PLC and supporting the NHS. Natalie, in her role, is now one of the leading authorities on the really complex ethical challenges that arise around genomic technology, which we'll get into, and what this means for patient data, basically. So Natalie's got over a decade of experience in ethics, policy, and governance of emerging data-driven health technologies. She was previously a senior leader at the Wellcome Trust, and has a PhD in philosophy. And last, but by no means least, she's one of my best friends, and I've known her for 20 odd years, and it's an honor to have her on the show. So, Dr. Natalie Banner, welcome to the Health Tech Hour. How are you?
Thanks very much, Steve. Wow, what an intro. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. So let's dive straight into it, right? We're a broad church on the show. So I always like to try and get a basic understanding of some terminology straight out the gate. So how would you describe genomics, and when did it start being a thing?
A thing. Okay. So if you think about historically, when we've explored concepts around genetics, you might think that you could have a genetic test, for example, for a particular condition. There are a few that people might well be familiar with. You might have, for example, BRCA tests, or we're aware of like tests for Huntington's disease involves a change in a single gene. Genomics is the study of a person's entire genetic makeup. So rather than looking just at one or two individual genes and where there might be some variants or some changes that could be causing a disease or could be creating risk for an individual, genomics is the study of the whole of someone's genetic makeup. And this is particularly powerful when you're looking at rare conditions, but also cancer. Cancer is fundamentally a disease of the genome. Something has gone wrong in your genetic makeup when you have cancer. So looking across the whole of an individual's genetic makeup has a huge amount of power and potential. Now, when the human genome was first initially sequenced over 20 years ago, there was the Human Genome Project. There was a huge amount of excitement, because people thought that if we could read the entirety of someone's genome, that's like 3 billion base pairs, essentially, the A's, the C's, the T's, the G's that make up your entire genome. We thought that if you could read all of that, you could understand all of it. And that was perhaps a little bit overambitious and maybe underplayed the complexity of what we've since discovered, which is just because you can see all the letters doesn't mean you understand what's going on. And actually, the science of genomics has really evolved over the past 20 years since the Human Genome Project, when that first draft complete human genome was created, in ways that help us understand just how complex it is. And we're very much in the foothills, really, of learning all of the complex interactions between those different letters, between genes, between regions of the genome that might code for proteins, those that might do other things, and the function of those genes is phenomenally complex. So the science of genomics has really developed over the past 20 or so years. We're still very much learning about where there's potential in scientific research and for clinical implementation. But fundamentally, if you think about genomics, it is looking across your entire genetic makeup to try and find causes of disease and potential risk factors or things that might protect you from getting certain conditions.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit. That was a wonder. It's like almost like you'd practiced that. The bit about BRCA. So BRCA is the breast cancer gene. Is that correct? So, but then you said cancer was also a disease of the genome. So, what's the sort of difference, inherent difference between the BRCA gene, which is very specific for breast cancer, versus cancer in its entirety being something related to the whole genome? I might have got that wrong. I feel slightly out of my depth already, and I'm already into 10 minutes of the show.
No problem. So, I mean, so to take the BRCA example, there's a couple of different variants of the BRCA gene. And essentially, if you have one of those variants, you are at a higher likelihood of developing breast and sometimes ovarian cancer as well. So essentially, what that the presence of that genetic variant indicates you're at a higher risk.
Okay.
When I say that cancer is a disease of the genome, what I mean is essentially cancer involves cells multiplying out of control, because that's what a tumor is. A tumor is a mass where you have cells that have just gone out of control in terms of their replication, and they're growing, and they're causing all sorts of problems. That essentially is a problem of how the genetic makeup within each cell is being translated. So it's causing the cell to send out instructions to reproduce constantly. And that's what I mean when I say it's a disease of the genome, because something's gone wrong in the instructions. And if you think about your genome as essentially the whole set of instructions, for making proteins that build up into cells that make you you. When those things go wrong, sometimes cancer is the result because these cells end up sort of uncontrollably replicating.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. And what over the last 20 so years, it was 20 years ago you said they finished the Human Genome Project, is that
The
right?
draft, yeah, the
Give
first
or
draft,
take.
yeah.
Did that really sort of start the gun on what we now call today genomics? It's the science of genomics.
It did to some extent. The thing that's really made the difference over the past maybe 10 years or so, and actually, from Genomics England's inception in 2013, the thing that's really made the difference is the availability of massive amounts of data. So the Human Genome Project initially was, it really was the sort of first attempt to create a complete human genome. But of course, all you can tell from that is, okay, we've got all these letters, we've got all these base pairs. We can't necessarily tell what out of that may be contributing to disease, or not. And so the thing that's really made the difference is the ability, A, to get whole genome sequences from lots and lots and lots of people, and B, to connect that to clinical data so that you
Very
can look
interesting.
and compare different people to say, okay, well, this individual's got this kind of variation, and they have this condition or this symptom. That looks an awful lot like this other person here who also has this variant and this condition. And you start building up correlations. And the thing that's begun to make that began to make the difference after the whole genome project was the ability to undertake what's called genome-wide association studies, which enabled this connection between here is an interesting genetic variant, here is a symptom or a condition. We think we found a correlation there. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily imply cause, but it gives you an indication of where the research can lead. That's the thing that's really made the difference in genomics. And actually, from Genomics England's perspective, our ability to pull together information from an awful lot of people with different conditions and undertake research into that involving linked clinical data, symptoms, and conditions, that's the thing that's really enabled genomics to begin to advance and critically have that connection back into clinical practice.
And is that one of the reasons why Genomics England was set up in the first place? Did people realize that that was the next gap, if that made sense? There was like you said, you could read the letters in the base pairs, but there was no context or sort of
Yeah,
that needed to get solved.
limited context and small scale studies. So lots of small scale studies with particular conditions, but very, I mean, you are looking for needles in a haystack here. So,
Okay.
for example, if you think about your 3 billion base letters in your genome, we have what's called a reference genome to sort of compare to. So we undertake a whole genome sequence and we compare it to what is essentially a composite of a kind of standard reference human genome. And what you do from there to identify possible causes of disease is that you compare the genome that you sequence to a reference genome and you find all of these different places where it's different.
Okay.
Each of us will have about 6.5 million of those. How
Wow.
on earth do you start narrowing down to find the needle in the haystack that might be the cause of a condition or a risk factor or so on?
Wait.
You have to build
Wow.
up this really massive data set and collection to filter down over time to see, what are the potential, disease-causing variants in that individual. And
Yeah, that must be
the
really difficult.
it's really difficult. It's the task of every clinical geneticist to determine which of these variants are possibly the ones that might be causing a condition. So to answer your question before, the main benefit from being able to pull masses of data from lots of different people is to be able to begin to start filtering down the variants that might be of interest, that might be disease causing, or creating risk, compared to all the noise that just comes from natural human variation, things that
Like
aren't causing any
that
problems
doesn't change
whatsoever.
anything about your overall
Exactly.
health picture.
Yeah,
But that
exactly.
sounds like a Herculean task. I mean, 6.5 million differences from whatever's considered to be the base is massive. Like, how
Yeah.
many do you think actually, and maybe this is not the right way to think about it, is there some concept of how many genes matter or genetic different? Like, how, no,
Yeah.
that's the wrong way to think about it. But if there's on average 6.5 million deviations from the norm, but some of it's noise, like how much of it tends to be noise?
Well, this is where having a lot of data from different people really helps you, because from that 6.5 million, on average, probably 700,000 of those might be pretty unusual. So you
Okay.
can discount a lot of those. About 3,000 of those variants might be predicted to cause a change in a protein. And often the change in a protein is a good indication of something that might be causing a disease or a condition because it affects how the cell functions. And then the other thing you can do, especially if you're talking about rare conditions, is to do whole genome sequencing on parents as well. So for quite a
Okay.
lot of the people that we and participants that we work with, if it might be a child with a rare condition, for example, if you do whole genome sequencing on the parents, the genetic parents and the child, that again is another filter to apply to figure out, okay, well, this parent has this variant, but they don't have the condition. That's probably not the thing that's causing it. So there's lots of different
Interesting.
layer, like lenses, essentially, you can apply to the data to slowly filter down over time. But this is the task of clinical genetics and clinical geneticists. Their task is to try and identify, which of these variants might be the thing to focus on. And that might be for a
Wow.
diagnosis, it might be something to inform treatment. There's a
Wow.
huge amount of work to do there for genetics. But the benefit of having a whole genome in the first place is that you can look in unexpected places. So historically, where let's say we're talking about the rare condition context, a geneticist might apply a panel test looking for a couple of areas, a few areas where they thought a genetic change might be the cause of a condition. But that relied on them having that idea in the first place and knowing that that might be where to look. The advantage of looking across a whole genome and having that data, being able to do research on that data, is that you can find things in unexpected places. So there was a really, really interesting case last year of a new syndrome that was identified using data that we hold in our National Genomic Research Library. Two separate research teams
Okay.
made this finding in quite quick succession. They were looking in a part of the genome that you wouldn't normally look to for causes of developmental disorders, and they
Okay.
identified a very, very small genetic change in a particular area of chromosome 12 related to the RNU42 gene. And as a result of that, they figured out that that could be the cause of around 1% of neurodevelopmental conditions, which
Wow.
doesn't sound like a
No,
lot.
but that's a high number
But
in
it's
absolute
huge.
terms.
But it's huge. And the critical thing was because that was
In
done
sorry,
with our
all neurodivergent conditions.
not neurodivergent,
Sorry.
developmental, neurodevelopmental conditions.
Neurodevelopmental,
So we're
sorry.
talking about developmental delays, challenges in speech and language, presence of seizures. These are things that are quite often very, very hard to pin down a diagnosis for.
Yeah.
And those research teams made this discovery, and critically, within, a few months, we were telling families. And
Wow.
it didn't give them answers in terms of treatment, but it helped them find each other. And they actually named the syndrome. They called it Reneu syndrome. So it shows the power of being able to bring all this data together
And it also
and
sh
actually get answers to
it
patients
sh
and
it's a bit
families.
like looking at the seabed, right? We're like we know barely anything about the floor of the ocean, and like every now like there's just must be so much untapped discoveries, and you can't cure something you can't diagnose.
Exactly. And even just being able to find some answer as a starting point is incredibly helpful and powerful for families who up till that point may well have felt like they had no answers and no idea how to navigate the situation and the
So I
system.
know that there's this whole area of like mitochondrial related conditions. Is that could they be caused genetically? Or like I know that there's some that have a name, but then there's a whole kind of continuum of ones they haven't really. They know it's an issue with the mitochondria, but they don't really have it sort of fixed yet.
Yeah, so mitochondrial conditions are really interesting ones, and in this country we have legislation that does allow for mitochondrial replacement. That was legislation that was passed a few years ago to prevent mitochondrial conditions from being inherited and from being passed down.
I didn't even know. Wait, you can replace your own mitochondria. You can get your mitochondria replaced.
I mean, you probably can't.
No, one can. One, it's feasible. It's scientifically feasible.
It is, well, it's scientifically feasible to use a surrogate to replace the mitochondrial DNA.
Wow.
in a fertility process. That was legislation that was passed in this country a few years ago. The very, very early stages of kind of rolling it out. It's been very tightly regulated. But yeah, phenomenally powerful work that.
And what are the ethics around mitochondrial DNA? Like, what's the kind of spread of the ethics around that? Why did that even come into, why was that even, why did that come to pass? Because of those conditions? Or what's the sort of.
Yeah, so for mitochondria, and this is my referring to my kind of old hat when I was working at Wellcome Trust, that was very heavily involved in this work. Essentially, the challenge there was you have mitochondria which sits outside of the usual cell nucleus, and it's passed down the maternal line.
Okay.
So it's if you know these conditions are heritable, and it was became sort of scientifically and technically feasible to essentially take the nucleic material from an embryo. So you know you've fully got your parents' genes, your genetic child or parent, but essentially that nucleus is then placed into a cell that has mitochondrial DNA that is functioning properly,
Wow.
and then that can you know that can be used to create an embryo that can then, you know,
That's
be born as a
amazing.
human. It's
Right. On
amazing.
that
Yeah.
note, we're going to go for our first commercial break now with my guest on today's show, Dr. Natalie Banner, who is the Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer at Genomics England. We'll be right back where I want to really dig into, start to dig into the ethics around what we're doing around genomics. So we'll be right back after 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's show with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Dr. Natalie Banner, who is the Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer at Genomics England. So thank you so much, Dr. Banner, for giving us the full rundown on the history of genomics. So I've got one question, and then I want to jump into this ethics area, and particularly when people started to realize that maybe we should be keeping a track of this ethics stuff with this stuff. But when I think a lot of people listening will be familiar with the concept of like getting a genetic test, right? Like, is it ancestry or whatever? Like getting a genetic test is kind of, is well known. Is that what we're also talking about with genomics, or are they slightly different?
So in the context of the work that we do whole genome sequencing, usually in a diagnostic or therapeutic context, but also at Genomics England, we run sort of research programs that aim to really drive the evidence base for genomic research in medicine. The context of getting kind of genetic tests, for example, to explore ancestry or to find out a bit more about your health or those sorts of things, they're called direct-to-consumer tests. And they are, I guess, a slightly different context. So they're often provided by commercial providers. The kind of information you get back, sometimes people find it really useful, but also it's often not quite clear, you know, what are you comparing it to? So if you get a test result back that says, you know, you have a 15% increased risk of cardiovascular disease, to use a pop.relevant example, it's not always clear, well, in relation to what kind of reference population are we talking about compared to other people of my age, other people of a similar ancestry?
Do these companies have access to the same base genome that you mentioned before, the comparator?
I mean, the reference genome is something that's, you know, the genomics community has been very much, you know, advocating at the forefront of open science, of trying to make, you know, information available. You know, obviously, when we're talking about individuals' genomes, there's huge numbers of sort of privacy and confidentiality safeguards there.
Yeah.
But in terms of the kind of the base science and the, you know, things like reference genome, yeah, absolutely. Okay. But quite often these are proprietary contexts. So you won't necessarily know, you know, what's the data they're comparing to, what happens to the information you provide, those sorts of things. So there's definitely a value and a use for them. And if people find them useful, that's great. The context we operate in is more on that kind of diagnostic, therapeutic, and research, in that that kind of longitudinal research that's more in the public benefit.
So, and I think that brings us quite nicely to this area of why ethics is so important. So do you want to give us the kind of, or can you give us the spread, so to speak, on the ethical debate around genomics and the areas potentially that you think have been developing into really interesting areas of debate?
Sure. How long have you got? So I guess there's a couple of areas. The first is around the fact that genomics is very, very data intensive. If you think about, you know, I talked about, you know, 3 billion base pairs in your genome. This is a massive amount of data. And we don't fully understand all of the implications of that data. So there's one very, very significant area in the ethics around genomics, which is essentially around data ethics, data governance. How do you ensure that that data is kept securely, that you're respecting privacy and confidentiality, and that any research that's undertaken on that data is, you know, not going to identify that individual? Your genomic data is inherently pretty rich. There's a huge amount of information in there. It's hard to fully make it anonymous, because the more information you extract from it or remove from that data, the less useful it is for research. So there's an interesting balance to strike there between utility and ensuring that data can be kept private.
Is that because you need to be able to correlate it to things in the real world sometimes?
Yeah. And also, you know, I mentioned before about the example of a genetic variant that was kind of hard to find and no one would be looking for it. It's, you know, you use the analogy of the seabed. We're not entirely sure what's down there. And so it's very hard to know in advance, you know, what information do we need to remove in order to ensure that data is going to be used safely. Our solution to that is to hold all the genomic data we have that participants have consented to in a secure environment. So researchers have to come to it. They have to go through an approvals process. It has to be clear what their purposes are, you know, and the data doesn't leave that environment. And that's a way of ensuring that, you know, that it's a safeguard against potential misuse. So there's a big chunk of ethical issues that are just around, you know, data governance, management, protection, ensuring that privacy can be protected, given that genomic data is inherently going to be quite rich and granular. Then there's another set of ethical issues, which is around the technology in and of itself. You know, genomics is a technology that is evolving quite quickly. We don't necessarily have you know, full sight of how it's going to, as with many technologies, how it's going to evolve in the coming years. And we are talking about something that is very intrinsically tied often to people's sense of identity, their sense of who they are. You know, you've inherited your genetics and your genes from your parents, your ancestors. There is a very rich sense in which your genomic makeup is very tied to who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. And it may also have very strong cultural implications, for example. So we're not just dealing with something that's like, you know, your Other kinds of your bank details or other information about you that could be changed. Your genetics you can't change if there's a hack or a breach or something, and it may be very, very intrinsically tied to your identity. And related to that, you know, the possibilities of genomics, there are discussions around, you know, things like gene editing, and would we, you know, attempt to make changes to someone's genetic makeup in order to prevent disease, to prevent conditions. That brings in a huge range of ethical issues around what and who we value in society. Mm. And that's a very, very powerful area of ethics and genomics, because we don't want to create a world or an environment that doesn't value the huge richness and diversity of human experience and human identity.
Well, and also, like, if you start making judgment calls about what's desired and not desired, we've seen that movie before and it doesn't end brilliantly well.
Exactly.
What was your route into this area? Because whenever you and I have talked about it, I find it fascinating, but it's almost limitless. I mean, those areas in and of themselves are so detailed and nuanced and complex and ever-changing. So what was your kind of pathway into this sort of area? And I guess the second part is, how do you try and stay focused on nailing some of these things down when they're sort of ever evolving?
Yeah. I mean, I can tell a beautiful sort of, you know, post hoc rationalized story about how I've ended up here. I have to be honest, at the start of my career, I didn't ever anticipate sort of ending up quite where I am now. But I've always been really interested in bridges across disciplines, sectors, different, you know, realms of expertise. That's a strong sort of thread across my career. You and I met, Steve, when we were at university. I was doing philosophy, psychology and physiology at the time. I was really interested in how different academic disciplines could talk to each other and learn from each other. So that kind of interdisciplinarity has always been just a particular interest of mine. I then went on to do research in the philosophy of psychiatry. So I was using tools from philosophy of mind and language and science to explore clinical questions in psychiatry. My PhD focused on how we can understand the concept of rationality in psychiatry and where people are maybe unable to make decisions for themselves. And that, again, was very much trying to take the concepts and the tools and the language of one discipline and see how they could shed light on problems and questions in another. So that's always been the kind of motivating factor for me. I got as far as doing a postdoc in philosophy of psychiatry, and sort of had this dawning realization that much as I loved it and was interested in it and was very intellectually fascinated by it, I did want to move into a space where I could have a bit more of that impact and make a bit more of a difference. So I was looking for more applied areas to work in. And whilst doing a postdoc, I was lucky enough to undertake a fellowship at POST, the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. Really great resource, by the way, if you're looking for like short, very well evidenced and balanced briefings on key topics in science and technology in the UK. It's basically an offshoot of the library in Parliament, and they produce these very, very detailed, what they call post notes, which are essentially summaries and briefings for parliamentarians to learn about, you know, key issues in science and technology. And I undertook this 3-month fellowship there and really enjoyed it and realized actually a policy focus might be really interesting for me. So from there, I joined the Wellcome Trust in their policy team and quickly picked up a brief around the ethics and governance of genetic data. Mm. And this was around the time when the issues around privacy and confidentiality of genetic data were really butting up against the desire for open scientific sharing of information and insight, and actually figuring out as a research funder how to ensure the confidentiality and privacy of genetic data that was being gathered through lots and lots of exciting research projects against the scientific need to enable, you know, that information to be shared. I sort of really cut my teeth then on the ethics and governance of genetic data. I was involved in a project in Africa as well, H3 Africa, human heredity and health in Africa, where I was heavily involved in that sort of ethics and regulatory work streams on how do you do undertake genomic research in those different contexts, and learned an awful lot there about the different cultural perspectives on genomics. Really made me realize just how differently different people thought about genetics and genomics and patterns of inheritance, And the relationship to identity, which I referenced before. And that was sort of really where I developed this, I guess, niche and expertise in the ethics of and governance of health health data, including genetic and genomic data and health health data technologies. And I did a lot of work there around sort of new technologies and led some work with an initiative called Understanding Patient Data that really explored with patients and the public and research participants how they felt about the use of health data for research purposes. And it's really interesting because I think that the same applies with genetics and genomics. You talk about data and health data, and people will either fall asleep because it's really dull, or they'll be terrified about what you're going to do. And it's kind of one of those, it's very, very hard to talk about it in a way that's compelling and engaging and interesting for people.
There's definitely some hot buttons or hot topics, or like, do they call them like lightning rods or whatever you want to call them? Like one I've heard in, and I came up when I was doing the research for the show is sort of like, oh my God, maybe this is more American because of the insurance concept, but it's, oh my God, are you going to share my genetic data with my insurer? And my insurance premiums will go up, or I won't be able to get insurance because they'll see something in my code, my genomic profile that I didn't know about. So, what's your sort of take on that issue? Real, not real, valid, well, I mean, not valid.
Currently, there is a code of conduct with the Association of British Insurers that prevents them from being able to ask for genetic information if you've had a diagnostic test for anything except Huntington's disease, if you are seeking a life insurance premium over £500,000, I think it is. So there is a very strict, you know, rule set around insurers being able to ask for information that has been provided that you've maybe sought out or that you've had a genetic test for. So that's the current situation in the UK. I think, you know, in the US, it's very different where you have a very different sort of insurance context. But it is an issue. And when we engage with research participants, people who might want to participate in some of our programs, very often, you know, the questions, it comes back to what I said before about data governance and data ethics. Very often the questions are about, well, who'll get access to that information? Can it be used by insurers? Will it be sold to marketing companies? And so on. And we've got, you know, a very, very strict policy around who is able to access the data that we hold. But it's a very natural concern for people. And so in exploring those kind of questions and concerns about data use, that was really what led me to end up joining Genomics England, bringing that perspective of how to talk about data and technologies in interesting ways. A lot of work on kind of public and community engagement, and then that policy advocacy as well. And the policy advocacy piece was particularly interesting because I did a lot of work on trust and what it takes for organizations to be trustworthy with data.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a really interesting element of this, the agenda around genomics now, because it is fundamentally uncertain what the future might hold. And you need trust where knowledge ends, right? Trust only kicks in where there's information you just don't know. So this notion of what it takes to be a trustworthy steward of data is a very, very big part of my remit now at Genomics England. So there's a kind of thread there that you can see about how I've sort of ended up where I am today.
I think that's really, really insightful and a really nice way of mapping it. And on that issue of a trustworthy guardian, I mean, one of the other stories that came up in my research is what, I don't know if it's already happened, but it was happening, was around the sort of sale slash bankruptcy of 23andMe. And for those of you that don't, 23andMe was one of the consumer facing genetic testing companies. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And if not the largest, I don't know, but certainly one of the most high profile. And they either were in administration or are in administration. And technically they have this big database of everyone's genetic profiles, which is technically an asset. Right, which would be up on the block as part of any bankruptcy proceeding.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big areas. Again, we got lots of questions about this. You know, we are, as Genomics England, we are a UK government-owned company.
Yeah.
We're very much funded by government. And from our perspective, that the idea of a data set as an asset is something that we would really not see as being a kind of I guess a kind of an asset with dollar signs in front of it. You know,
no,
I think
it
for
can't be.
23andMe, obviously it was part, you know, that's the issue of it being a kind of commercially driven entity. But it's something that does cause questions for people. What will happen to this data in the long run? How will it be managed and used over time? And we are holding that information for a long period of time.
But I think credit to the UK government for creating Genomics England, I think. Right. I think that seems to be very forward thinking and very smart, actually. I mean, they come in for a lot of stick about a lot of things, but, you know, like that seems to be quite smart, actually.
Yeah. It was a very forward thinking endeavor at the time. And the critical thing that makes it so interesting was the model that was employed was this. We're not part of the NHS, but we're very, very closely connected to it, and we work very closely in partnership. So that innate, it's a really interesting model for kind of enabling evidence and data generation, evidence generation around genomic research and and those connections with that research community, but then plugging back into the health system. And that's pretty unique. There's not many places that are able to do that.
No, that is really neat because you've got the arm's length thing, which means you have independence. You're not sucked into the clinical pathways and things like that. You're not on the front line of the clinical machine, but you can plug into it where you need to, which I think is the best way. So we're going to go for our last commercial break on today's show with my guest today, Dr. Natalie Banner, who's the Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer at Genomics England. And we'll be back with the last part. And in this part, I want to pick up on some of the stuff around the 10-year plan. And there was a few things that hit the headlines around that plan that I want to pick up on. That we can jump into to just try and sort of establish what actually is real and what isn't. So we'll be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest on today's show, Dr. Natalie Banner, who's the Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer at Genomics England. So let's just scroll forward a little bit to the 10-year plan. So 10-year plan came out, 2 months ago, something like that. Genomics was everywhere in it. There was barely a page of it that did not mention the genomics and how genomics will yield this glorious future of prevention and faster treatments and personalized medicine and all of these different things. So obviously that was all really aspirational, which was like great in one way, but how much of that was hyperbole versus reality, and what does the pathway look like to some of those big wins, if you like, you think? To the extent that you're able to share your opinion.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, the first thing to say is in England, we have a genomic medicine service, right? This is standard of care for individuals to receive genetic testing and in some cases a whole genome sequence if it's indicated in various types of cancer and rare conditions. That is something that exists. Mm-hmm. So we already have, thanks to the Genomic Medicine Service, a pathway and an embedded service. And at Genomics England, we provide whole genome sequencing services for that to support that genomic medicine service. So to that extent, some of this is real already, right? It is there. The difference, I think, in the 10-year health plan was the potential for using genomics in In different contexts, in broader contexts. At the moment, it is cancer and rare conditions.
Okay.
But there's a lot of ambition around potentially using it in more predictive and preventative, preemptive contexts. And that takes genomics out of the realm of very specialist clinical genetic services into being more about potentially population health and being able to preempt conditions or risks using genomics. That is a big shift. It's a very ambitious shift. But what we're doing at the moment is trying to sort of build the evidence and the digital infrastructure to really enable that that set of possibilities to happen. In terms of our work in Genomics England, one of the things that we are working on is this is the idea that potentially within the next 10 years, genomics could inform up to half of all healthcare interactions.
Wow.
And one of the ways that we think that could happen is if you think about all of the different types of healthcare interactions across the health system, lots of them are around prescribing. Whether that's in the hospitals or in primary care. And there are some really interesting initial work going on, particularly in Manchester, for example, about the idea of using genomic information to help with prescribing decisions. And that's known as pharmacogenomics, which sounds like a complex word, but it's essentially, drugs and genomics. How can you use your genomic information to predict, are you likely to have an adverse reaction to a certain kind of drug? Or does your genomic profile tell us something about how you should dose that particular drug? So if we can get to a place where we've generated evidence around this, it's possible that we could start to see genomics being more part of much more day-to-day prescribing decisions, not just in these quite specialist contexts around sort of cancer diagnostics and rare conditions.
And how on earth would you actually do that? Because I understand with like cancer and rare conditions, because you're basically, I guess, trying to find the gene or protein that's been altered or whatever this right phrase is, right? But how would you do that when you were looking to see whether someone may or may not have an adverse reaction to a particular drug? How would that play out?
There's some great research already. There's a lot of, for example, I can't pronounce the name, clopidogrel. I always get the wrong, clopidogrel.
Rather you than me there on that
one. Yeah. is an example of a drug where, you actually can, if you get your sort of genomic information and the variants you have will make a difference to whether or not you should be prescribed clopidogrel, you could have an adverse reaction to it. So there's a lot of research into pharmacogenetics already that exists.
Oh, really?
The question is, well, if you wanted to do this at scale, there's lots of scientific questions about accuracy, validity, penetrance. Is it anything that you talk about in terms of screening or population health, public health context? There's always going to be a question of false positives, false negatives. What might you miss? What might you say that there's an issue, but actually there isn't? That's a very, very sort of well-trodden area, I guess, around the ethics of public health interventions and particularly screening. So, there's a lot of really interesting research going on at the moment that explores what kinds of indications might be beneficial to have genomic information for.
And how do you handle the ethics on those larger scale, how do you consider or think through, or are you starting to think through the ethics on those larger scale things? Because it is different when you're effectively trying, you're casting a really wide net without it being targeted. Because with the genomics medicine service, from what I understand, is someone's presenting with something clearly, and then their genome is being screened to better inform their treatment, I guess.
Yes.
When you're casting this wide net, one of the stories that was, I'm not sure the exact truth of this, but it was let's screen every baby or something was the sort of the title of it. What are the ethical considerations with that stuff? Because you're casting such a wide net without any pre-existing diagnostic.
And without people presenting with symptoms. So you talked about the baby screening. That was probably reference to one of the studies that we're undertaking at the moment, one of our major research programs, which is called the Generation Study. And this is an exploration to, again, generate evidence. It's a research study. We don't know the answers yet. We don't know the outcomes. But essentially, it's exploring the feasibility and the utility and the acceptability of using whole genome sequencing in a newborn screening context. Now, currently, when a baby is born in England, they will have a heel prick test, which is basically take a small prick of blood from the heel, and there will be a screening test for 9 conditions, metabolic conditions largely, that we know that if you get in there early, you can treat through diet, through certain interventions, but there's 9 of them. We are undertaking a research study to screen for over 200 rare conditions. Now, critically for those conditions, they are childhood onset, so they have to be onset before the age of 5. We are only looking at ones for which we are very, very confident that if you have the variant, you will get the condition.
So high conviction.
And exactly. So there has to be a high evidence threshold, and there has to be a clinical pathway within the NHS, because what we don't want to do is treat it. Exactly. What we don't want to do is return results to parents and there be no way forward. So the way that that study has been designed has had ethics really baked in from the outset. That has involved, before we even set up the study, a quite a large scale public dialogue. And that's a really important part of our ethics approach, is that engagement piece, because we cannot possibly know what all of the sensitivities, the views, the values, perspectives are of patients, of families, of participants, or the general public in advance of developing a program on this. So a huge amount of engagement work, a lot of user research with prospective parents, also clinical groups, patient advocacy groups, clinicians, midwives, and so on, fed into the design of that study, so that we could, as far as possible, anticipate ethical questions, navigate those effectively, work out things like what's the right consent model for a study like that. How do you inform people, especially if we're talking in newborn context? Pregnant women have got enough on their plates, right? There's a lot going on. You do not want to be sitting there with a consent form that's several pages long while they're in labor. So a lot of thought went into how to inform people about the study, what the results might be if they got a result that indicated their child might have a condition that then has a confirmatory test, again, within the NHS. So we're not giving back results that don't have, you know, we're not confident about. And you may have seen some press last week reporting on a really great example of how this has actually made a difference. So there was a baby called Freddie who was part of the generation study. His parents consented to having a sample of his cord blood taken at birth. That went through our pipelines, and there was an indication that he might have a variant for a rare eye cancer, a retinoblastoma. And because that result was returned really quickly, they followed up with testing and managed to intervene early and potentially save his sight. So he's undergone surgery and chemotherapy, and essentially this kind of cancer causes cancer cells to develop on the retina, which can often cause sight loss, and it's only picked up once it's obvious that the baby's unable to see properly. So by getting there early and that in that newborn context, we've hopefully helped this child's sight. So it's an example of what the impact might be, but it's underpinned by this huge infrastructure of careful consideration of all the different possibilities, false positives. How's a parent going to feel about, you know, the ethics of undertaking a research project like this?
So I think, and like, don't yell at me about this, but I think that some people might think the stereotype about sort of ethical debate is just sort of a bit of sort of pontificating about various different things. But what you're basically laying out there is it's highly applied and very directional around how to ensure that we deliver the maximum impact with the maximum level of care for anyone participating. Definitely. which is, so like, ethics is a tool to deliver things safely as opposed to just people sitting around having a chat about various philosophical issues.
Exactly. It's not philosophical, and it's also not a compliance issue, right? This isn't just about, you know, let's get our research ethics approved. This is about how are we going to bring this research study, and it is research, it is evidence generation, into a healthcare setting in a way that is understandable, in a way that people can feel informed about, and to be able to make choices for themselves. And really trying to navigate what some of the things could go wrong. How are we going to address those? How are we going to mitigate them? that's very much part of the sort of ethics approach we take. So it's not compliance, it's not sort of abstract theory, it's very practically applied. And the critical thing for us is there are bound to be things that we haven't anticipated, but we want to put in place the kind of the right apparatus and the right perspectives, the right expertise and the right engagement so that we can navigate those things effectively when they do arise. The one of the things that I'm really driven by and forms a really core part of the way I think about ethics and the relationship with engagement with communities and with participants is one of my favorite books is it's called The Lathe of Heaven. It's by Ursula Le Guin. She's a brilliant sci-fi writer. And there's a quote in this book, which is has really stuck with me since I first read it, and it really does guide me. It goes, to do any good at all, just thinking that you're right and your intentions are good isn't enough. You have to be in touch. And that, for me, is what really guides our ethics approach. We can't just sit here and say, well, this is the ethical thing to do here. We've weighed up all of these different considerations and this is the right way forward. You have to be in touch with the people and the populations you're trying to serve. And that really does drive our ethics approach at Genomics England.
And how different is that to other countries? Because I'm guessing other countries have similar or, you know, analogous setups. Like how does the UK stack up? Obviously, yeah, I'm sure you're going to be very modest about it, but like what's the kind of state of play out there beyond our borders?
Lots of really interesting work in many different places. I mean, I referenced the newborns, the generation study. There's a lot of different countries that are setting up similar kinds of programs, taking slightly different approaches. I think the UK does have a reputation for introducing and developing new technologies, particularly in healthcare, in a way that is in step with public acceptability and considerate of those perspectives. I mentioned mitochondrial donation earlier. That law only changed in light of a huge amount of engagement work and understanding of public sensitivities. We have quite a good culture of deliberative processes. Citizens' juries are often used as a sort of a tool of engagement to inform policy development. So I think in the UK, we're pretty good at making sure that we're bringing different public perspectives into the development of policy and technology. The area that I'd say that we need to think more about is ensuring that we're doing that in a way that's fair and representative. Mm. And equity of access to research, equity of the outcomes, ensuring that as a result of genomic analysis, for example, everyone can get the same kind of quality of care. That's a really big factor. And I think definitely more work to do there.
Makes sense. Right. Well, Natalie, we've come to the end of the show, and it was great to have you on. So before I ask everyone this, and you might have just done it with your sci-fi quote, so we might have missed the boat slightly, but I ask people to say, what is the one motto that they want to share with the world that they return to when things get tough or they have to work through difficult situations? So,
I did. I did preempt it. Yeah, no, I would say I would come back to you have to be in touch. And that means in touch with a really wide range of perspectives. We have to ensure that if we're developing technology, we haven't mentioned AI much today, but, you know, whether we're talking about data driven technologies, genomics, we have to be in touch with the populations and the communities that we're trying to serve, or else we'll do no good at all.
Well, on that note, Dr. Natalie Banner, Chief Ethics and Engagement Officer from Genomics England, thanks for coming on the show, and we'll be back again next week. Thank you to everyone for listening.
Thanks, Steve.
If someone told me that the world would end tonight, you could take all that I got for once, I wouldn't start a fight. You could have my liquor, take my dinner, take my fun, my birthday cake, my soul, my dove, take everything I love. But oh, one thing I'm never gonna do is throw away.